Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Yahoo Fantasy Baseball Podcast. I believe it's episode 8. We got a great guest for you today. We have one of the OGs of fantasy baseball, two-time Baseball Writer of the Year, FSWA Hall of Famer, one of the founders of RotoWire, Roto News originally, now RotoWire, which was a game changer in the fantasy industry. And he's going to join me. I should probably introduce myself. I'm Scott Pianowski, but I'm just so excited to talk about Jeff Erickson. Wanted to run through some of his accomplishments. Jeffrey, how are you?
I'm doing well. Those old awards are kind of getting a little dusty, though. I need a new one. I need to get back on it there, get another one there. But we'd go back way back in the day. You're one of the people that helped build Roto News. I mean, you were one of our very, very first writers for us. I'm glad that we're able to do this because I feel like we're kind of that same vanguard, same area of time that we both started writing in this industry.
I appreciate you saying that because I was also loath not to mention that whatever career I've made in this industry is in a great deal attributable to you and to Peter Schenke and the Tim Schuler and to I could list 30 people at RotoWire who have affected my life for the positive. So nothing but great things to say about that site. The only thing I don't like about RotoWire, and I said this to some of my friends at RotoWorld too, is just that you make the weaker fantasy player good and you make the good fantasy player great. It used to be, if you just read the USA Today, you had an information advantage 20 years ago, but you guys have made it so that all the people who play are better players now. It's harder to win leagues.
Oh, it is. It's absolutely harder to win leagues. Way back in the day, Peter Kreutzer and described the third stage hell of fantasy leagues, Roto leagues, and how, and Alex Patton too. I'd be remiss not to mention Alex, that, you know, there's the first stage where, okay, yeah, I have some more knowledge about baseball than you. Second stage, okay, we've all played in this league a couple of years. You know, we're getting better. Third stage, everybody knows the league. We're now like drafting off of each other's tendencies, let alone just our knowledge of the game. And it's writ large. And, you know, so much information is at our fingertips now. You know, it used to be, oh, strikeouts portend, you know, better success than past ERA does. Wow, that's groundbreaking. Now that's like, oh, that's so 15 years ago. Now it's like Statcast information at our fingertips, all the advanced metrics, and how to synthesize this is the real big skill. And just using all this information and transform that into game theory. There's a similar kind of path with poker, I imagine, where, you know, it used to be easy to beat the game, and now a lot of people get some basic skill. I think the error bar is wider probably in poker than it is in fantasy baseball, but I think it's a harder game to learn. But at the same time, it's there. You can see that parallel.
Right. Yeah. If you went into a poker room with a very broad base of fundamentals, you'd be successful 20 years ago without much of a fight. I'm not saying you'd win the World Series or anything, but you could probably do it for a living or at least eke out a nice side income. And now the game is a lot more complicated. But then by the same token, even though I feel like we're in an age of enlightenment, I also think that great William Goldman quote that nobody knows anything is kind of true, too. And let's transition to this season. I tweeted over the weekend, this baseball season feels like a football season. And what I mean by that is there's that whole trope of football starts and we play about a month and people start saying, this is the craziest season ever. And look at all these unheralded guys and look at all the injuries. And, you know, my team isn't doing anything like what I expected. Even the teams that are good are good for reasons I didn't see coming. The teams I thought were great, you know, all these guys are hurt, blah, blah, blah. Just what's your overview of how do we get here? I mean, 3 weeks in, homers are flying out of the park. All sorts of aces have either gotten hurt or gotten the crack kicked out of them. All sorts of guys are hurt. What's your general overview how are you trying to keep your feet on the ground and not be overly reactionary and yet try to do – you feel like you have to do something. What are you doing?
You know, it's a great question. And Saturday was insane in that regards. Mad Max gets bombed by the Marlins. Gerrit Cole gets destroyed by the Rangers. Now, granted, destroyed by the Rangers used to be a thing that happened all the time as recently as a couple of years ago. And guess what? That was our, you know, most juiced ball environment ever as far as a full season goes. And we're outpacing that this year. I think you have to remember the environment we're in and just remember you're going to take some lumps. It's weird. On established players, established aces in particular, for the most part, I want to kind of maintain the long view. I don't want to overreact because the fact is, I mean, everyone's going to get hit at some point in time. But at the same time, I mean, you can't let you have to look at fundamentals of individuals. You have to look at, okay, is the velocity really down? with Chris Sale, for instance. That I think is the hot button topic that we've had all season long, and he pitches again tonight, you know, if the weather permitting. But you know, you really want to wonder, okay, what is going on with this guy? Why is he different? And I think you have to do that with everybody. I think, and we have the ability to go more granular than we've ever done before.
Let's have some fun with some of these aces. And I'm going to give you a name of an ace pitcher, and I want you to give me your level of panic from zero, which is why you even asking me, to 10. Oh my God, take what you can get. I'm petrified. How do you feel 0 to 10 about Jacob DeGrom?
I would say probably 4. It would be lower in most cases, but for the Mets training staff issues in the past, where, you know, he might diagnose, you know, he's throwing over the, you know, on the side 2 days in a row over the weekend, gets diagnosed with scurvy on Tuesday. You never know with him. Or, you know, he could just, you know, or it could be nothing and he could be fine. I'd probably put him at about 4. You?
I'm in the same neighborhood. I may be colored by the fact that I need DeGrom in a couple of leagues. I like the fact that he played catch. If he was really broken, why would he be playing catch? I don't know. It's hard.
Mets,
you're trying
why.
To connect dots sometimes and you're guessing. Yeah, right. And the Mets, you know, that's a strange thing too with medical histories. When a team has so many bumps in the road with that, you wonder if there's something to it. But of course, you know, a lot of the personnel has changed in that front office too. I think Max Scherzer is probably like a 0 or 1 for me, but same. Since he's at the top of this list, yeah, same for you. No real concern. You hate when he goes to Miami and gets hit, but you know, everybody's going to get hit once or twice during the season anyway.
Right. And you know, he's not the first ace to get hit by Miami. You mentioned DeGrom, he got hit there, and also other pitchers that we liked. He was certainly not an ace, but Zach Eflin, you know, 2 great starts, then gets hit by Miami and then gets up 2 runs in Coors Field. Okay. Just sometimes the number comes up, but then, you know, the Cubs all get well like in Miami. It's really weird how that happens.
I feel like this is almost the Chris Sale podcast because I ask every one of my guests about Chris Sale, but we still don't have any answers. What's your number on Sale?
7, but I don't have them. You know, here's the thing that, you know, it's really kind of tricky about dealing with Chris Sale too, is I saw, you know, a couple of trades that have gone across the wire. Peter Schenke tweeted one out. Ray Flowers tweeted another one out. You play in leagues where you have trade vetoes. You can't even sell low on him if you want to. You know, you get people that veto your trades. It's really frustrating. But if you really feel firmly convinced that he's going down that Felix Hernandez path, well, then how are you going to get full value for him? You know, great. You can announce to the league that, okay, I'm going to trade. I'm going to try to get what I can. But guess what? People lowball you when you do that. You know, you're better off like going to individual owners and making trade proposals than you are broadcasting the league. But then you always get that one guy that says, "Why didn't you let me know? I would have topped that offer." No, you wouldn't have. You liar. You didn't. You could have. I mean, you weren't proactive in trying to trade for him. But I am worried. I mean, the thing is, the velocity is not just down; it's way down. And the poor success rate on his fastball in particular, that 4-seamer. Really bothers me. Keep in mind, he junked the sinker a couple of years ago to use the 4-seamer more often. He never uses that sinker anymore. If he's never using that and he's not using the 4-seamer, what's he going to use that's got that velocity? What's going to make that changeup and that slider work so well? That's what scares me.
Yeah, I saw a stat. I think it's still current because I don't think he's pitched since I saw this number, that he had 1 swinging strike on a fastball all season.
Yeah.
It's mind-blowing. A swing and a miss, that is. I'm sure there's been tons of foul balls, and you know, there's a value to that. But
right.
If he's not getting swings and misses on his fastball, I know his slider is his put-away pitch. And I also know that we're in an age where the fastball is getting phased out a little bit. There's always going to be a fastball in baseball, but it used to be a primary pitch. A lot of guys now, it's just something they work off. The idea is to throw it as little as possible. And in today's game, I don't think anybody really wants to throw their fastball over the plate unless it's a really elite fastball. But you know, that swing and miss number made me nervous. Now, granted, guys just don't get that many swings and misses on fastballs anyway. I think the leader was Cole, who had maybe at the time like 38 of 210 swings and misses. So maybe, you know, the idea is it's not going to be a swing and miss pitch as much as we want it to be anyway. But, you know, they're not swinging and missing at Sale's fastball, that's for sure.
Yeah, so the only encouraging thing is in that start against the Yankees, he hit a higher velocity he had in his previous starts. It's the only thing that I'm really only encouraged by just a little bit, that his average fastball was actually 95.5 on that one there. So that's the thing that has some encouragement there. But the success rate wasn't that great. In fact, you know, of the, you know, 8 at-bats where the final pitch was that 4-seamer, 5 were hits. And that's the thing. It's like, okay, he's not out of the woods yet. He's getting better, but he's not out of the woods. Maybe this whole them backing him off in spring training thing is going to work in the long run. And he'll be fine by the end of the month. You see that time with power pitchers from time to time. I referenced a Bill James abstract article on today's XM show, and it was way back in the day when Joe Altobelli was the manager for the Orioles, and he rejiggered the rotation so Storm Davis would get more April starts than Scott McGregor under the theory that hard throwers would do better. Hitters wouldn't want to have that when it's cold and all that. It turned out that backfired. McGregor was actually better than Davis, and Davis had trouble getting his full velocity then. I don't think we had the full. We obviously didn't have StatCast metrics behind that, but the notion is he found after the fact was that sometimes these power pitchers take a month to kind of hit their stride. And, you know, so with all these guys that throw really hard that are struggling now, maybe we should be a little bit more patient until it warms up.
There's a great question asked by Todd Zola in the Tout Wars table about how to handle what we're talking about, just the shape of baseball so far in 2019. And what I thought was a really tidy answer is I said that I was going to try to avoid pitching to contact pitchers, guys, and not just the soft tossers, but guys who didn't have elite strikeout rates. I thought maybe this is not the environment for them. And I specifically mentioned Miles Michaelis, Rick Porcello, and Kyle Hendricks. Liked my answer, thought it was a good answer. And of course, all three of them pitched great on the weekend, to varying degrees of great. Hendricks had a double digit strikeout game. Porcello was effective against Tampa Bay. And Michaelis, he only went about six innings, but he had a decent start. And I'm pretty sure picked up a win too. But my point stands that I thought these guys before the season, you know, Porcello has actually become about a strikeout per inning guy. I thought he's a durable pitcher. So I thought, okay, give me 190 innings. Give me 200 innings. It's for the Red Sox, presumably a 90-plus win team. I'm not sure if that's out the window yet, but, man, so many things going wrong for this team. I actually don't think it would be a surprise at all if the Red Sox missed the playoffs. I think right now they're maybe 70% to make it. I'm curious what you think about that. But I thought one of my – if I were going to start a league from scratch, which I actually might do this week – I was in on Michaelis and Porcello and Hendricks at the fact that I thought they were a little bit depressed in value before the season, so I was getting them at a decent price. I'm at the point now that unless they were absolute giveaways, maybe I could talk myself into Hendricks. You see that 10 strikeout game, and you know, but still, yeah. He lives in the high 80s. Is one of the takeaways that, look, in a world where contact is bad and when the ball goes over the fence a lot, the way around that is not to let the batter make contact.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny because you and I drafted next to each other in mixed labor, and I remember when I took Hendricks and Porcello both right before you, you were upset on both picks. I recall that vividly. They were the only two good picks I made in the entire draft. But, you know, it's funny how that works out that, you know, I'm more worried about Porcello than I am Hendricks. I don't know if that's rational because Hendricks is definitely losing velocity. But for some reason, I trust him a little bit more. Maybe it's just because of the, you know, Porcello being in the AL East. But, you know, I don't think I'm as extreme as you on that. I think I would be discounting them. But the thing is, you got to find somebody else to pitch. The disasters are coming everywhere. It's not just that tier. It's every tier. I mean, yeah, we are in a world where contact is getting punished a lot more. But, you know, at the same time, I don't know if Nick Pivetta wasn't a guy that was a contact guy, and he's in the minors. You know, you see a lot of trendy darlings that way in that same tier that are going, you got to find someone else to push up. You know, not everybody's going Joe Musgrove on us. You know, we have to find other guys that are really struggling.
Are you changing any of your roster construction? Are you using more relievers? Are you being more picky with streamers or two-step starters? Has anything seeped into your gameplay ability?
You know, we've been talking a lot about that. Chris, listen, I, especially on XM, and he's really pushing those, you know, high impact, late, you know, high leverage relievers. I'm not there yet. First of all, I guess I'm playing in contests there. You know, you play in the NFBC or the TGFBI where there's an overall contest too, and you just can't punt wins and strikeouts down the road. Yes, you may make up some ground with some of those high leverage relievers, but they get hit too. You know, Josh Hader got hit twice this weekend. You know, Kiki Hernandez got him on Friday. Cody Bellinger got him on Sunday. Lefty on lefty violence there. You know, the thing is, nobody's immune to this. Nobody. That's the reason why I'm hesitant to change. What I am doing, Scott, I think I am being more aggressive on streaming against the bad hit offenses. You know, and yes, you'll take some lumps against Miami and Detroit every once in a while, but you got to keep playing that card. It's like you just got to keep playing the percentages. And there's a certain number of teams that are bad offenses on the bad teams. And you just got to keep playing that. You got to keep going against the Giants. You got to keep going against the Tigers and the Royals and all that. And you'll get some bad starts every once in a while, but your likelihood of success is better. And that means expanding your choices among those pitchers going against those guys.
Right. Yeah. My drum all season has been the AL Central, Miami, and the Giants. Those are the spots I feel really good about. And I also think a takeaway from the Cole outing and the McHugh outing, not that you would ever bench those guys, but Texas is such an oppressive place to pitch. A former Major League Baseball player actually told me that when he would pitch in Texas, after the warm-up, he felt like he'd pitched the entire game because it was so disgustingly hot there almost the entire season. Like, you know, three-quarters of the season is like that. It's amazing to me it's taken so long for them to finally realize they have to go indoors. I don't know how Pudge Rodriguez didn't have a heart attack. Now, if you have, again, Cole is an ace. You have to pitch him. And I think McHugh had been so good that you probably just had to throw him out there too. But that, to me, Texas to me is the number two or number three park. Coors in a class of its own. Maybe Fenway is like that. But there's a very short list. I always feel like, think of it in fantasy football terms, right? I don't care if a defense is 13th against something or 17th against something. Tell me the defenses that are really good about against something or really bad against something, and I will work on those outliers. And I think that's kind of the way park factors are too. Texas, to me, is an outlier park. Again, you know, you could no way to get around Cole. But when I have someone who's in the middle of my staff or in the bottom of my staff, just like Coors Field, I am not letting them pitch in Texas.
Yeah, I go back and forth on that because a couple of years ago, it neutralized a little bit because they added those boxes and all of a sudden the wind patterns changed a little bit. Mm-hmm. You see Mike Minor throw a complete game shutout on Monday against the Angels or Tuesday, I think it was maybe. And you're like, okay, maybe it's not that bad after all. And then boom, rockets red glare this weekend. You know, Cole, by the way, I know he's tipping pitches, they said, on the Saturday start. I mean, you look a little closer. He's gotten strikeouts in his outings, but he hasn't been that dominant. And if it weren't for the distinction between unearned runs and runs, he looks a little worse. He gave up 3 unearned runs in his opening day outing, you know, or not opening day, but his first start against the Rays. He's not been that dominant yet. And he kind of was that way in September last year. I know we're really kind of picking nits with him, but it just shows nobody's safe. And that's the thing that's so really frustrating is like, how many guys do you really, really think like, I look forward to watching this start today? I mean, there's not that many.
Yeah, that's the funny thing. I was talking about that. You and I both wrote pieces last week that were very similar in scope and just about all this whole theme that we're talking about today. And I was joking that, you know, you buy the baseball package and you see when your pitchers are pitching and you mark off time and you look forward to it and you settle in and then you watch it and you're like, I look forward to this. It's like when you go on your golf trip and if you hit the ball poorly for a couple of holes, and teaser, we're going to be talking a little bit golf later in the show when we get to the draft, but it's like, I look forward to this all year, you know, and like I'm 7 over after 3 holes, but I still think Cole, I mean, 44 strikeouts in 29 to third innings. I mean, for all the age of enlightenment and all the metrics and all the Statcast data, which we're still learning how to apply it, I still think walks and strikeouts answer, they get you the Occam's razor part of things. I still think they get you an awful lot of the way there.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. But it's like, it used to be, yeah, I got 3 guys going tonight. This is going to be a good day. Now I'm 3 guys going and I'm terrified. And it's really funny how that, you know, the mindset plays. And then you get your kind of mediocre guy that's actually doing well. And you're like, okay, I'm just going to ignore that. Here's looking at you, Keller. I mean, I know you're not facing the AL Central this week and it's going to be ugly, but I still got you going in AL town because I have to. Okay, fine. Let's see what happens. Cross our fingers. But it's really funny how that all plays out. Now, the question I wonder is, you know, in 2016, the ball changed like mid-season. And there was some talk last year that they ran out of that batch like after a month or two. And that's why home runs were down last year as opposed to 2017. How do we know when the ball changes back, if and when it changes back?
I mean, we may not know. We probably don't know.
Right. And that's the thing about, and you almost want to make you want to throw up your hands and say, okay, what do we do about this? I mean, they're not going to let us know. They're not going to send out this press release. Hey, we got some higher seams now on the baseball. Just a heads up on that, guys. You're going to get a lot more resistance on that ball now. But that you know, the other thing is maybe that changes the velocity a little bit too from the pitcher's standpoint, not just the exit velocity, but how about the entrance velocity, if you will.
And also, if what happens is we don't have guys with ERAs in the low twos anymore, but the new ERA leaders become 2.8 or 3.0 and everybody moves up appreciably, it won't be an exact, you know, there won't be like a coefficient that perfectly aligns with everybody. But if it just is that, okay, we just have to recalibrate what it really means to be an ace. And instead of a guy like Scherzer or DeGrom may have just 1 or 2 bad starts in a year, maybe we have to expect 4 or 5. And the guys who were going to get, you know, 7 or 8 bad starts, they get 10 or 12, whatever. Everybody moves up. We just end up playing with different numbers. So we have to get more home runs so we can understand the pitch. I mean, it's just, it may be a case of we just have to get used to the different numbers and the different targets.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
Listening to the Yahoo Fantasy Baseball Podcast, I'm Scott Pianowski, your host, and we're joined by Jeff Erickson, again, an OG of fantasy baseball. He's in the FSWA Hall of Fame. He's got a bunch of awards that he won a long time ago, but he's still useful to talk to today. And Jeff, I'm really glad you mentioned the Great Fantasy Baseball Invitational, because like you, I'm in a bunch of different leagues, and I have some good teams, some bad teams. And so far, that happens to be my best team. I'm winning my league. I'm third overall in a contest that has, I don't know, 315 or 320 players. And the reason I mention this, other than to gratuitously boast of how great my team is two things. One, I have a theory that if you have an outlier team that's really, really good right now or really, really bad, there's a good chance that that team may be really good or really bad. I mean, I look at some of the teams that aren't doing well. My Tout Wars team already looks like a shipwreck. And even when I start to look at what could reasonably go right, okay, Chris Bryant's a little better than this, and hopefully Joey Votto will start to hit, and I'll ask you a question about Votto later. But I think it would be asking too much for that team to get in contention, because too many of the things, the potholes I've hit, just seem like I can't overcome them. I've hit some injuries on that team. It's a lot of Scooter Jeanette injuries, where it's like, how mad can you really get when a $10 player gets hurt? But you get enough of them, it does add up. There's a cascade effect. Here's my question to you. One, do you believe your outlier teams, good or bad? Do you feel more confident than usual that those teams are probably really are good or bad? And my team in the FBI league, I don't really have a lot. I know Liz was talking today about, you know, the Bellingers and the Yeliches. I don't have a lot of those guys. I do have Matthew Boyd, who seems like he's doing well. But the thing about this team, a couple of good pickups, whatever. It's been remarkably healthy. I've been injuries I've had have been extremely minor. I haven't had one of the kill shots. So my question to you is, do you believe that an extreme start to this point is likely to mean a really good or really bad season? And is there a way, these are two different questions, and take them in any order you want. If we went to a draft and just said, look, I want the healthiest team I can get, is it a fool's errand to even think that's an attainable thing? Or are we just, is this just the team I have that is lucky that I happen to not get guys who were hurt? I mean, yeah, I didn't draft the Severino types who maybe had one foot in the ditch already. But I have to think that I've been pretty lucky. This team has been relatively unscathed by injury in a season where there's been injuries all over the place. Is there an intelligent way to approach injuries, or is it just we're all kind of flying blind on it?
I think you actually approach it pretty well. We've talked about this. If we started talking about it in football, but it applies to baseball too. I mean, you avoid the guys that are already hurt right now. I think that's because they almost always take longer to come back from their injury than we expect. And they usually aren't the same level of performance, at least initially, when they come back. I mean, yeah, illness, fine. Okay, maybe he comes back from that quicker or something like that. But, you know, we look at, you know, Severino was an easy avoid for me. You know, it was rotator cuff inflammation. Yeah, thing is, you need your shoulder to pitch. Yeah, I'm gonna push him down. You know, he dropped forever in Yahoo Friends and Family with this. Genstad got him. And, you know, Scott's a very smart player. And, you know, when he grabbed him, I was like, okay, I don't like that Scott got him here. He's defending champ in this league. And now he's got a big discount on an ace. But I was like, at the same time, we all kept pushing him down. Nobody wanted to take that chance on him. There's good reason for that. And time and again, I think that's really one of the big things. I mean, yeah, you can't help it. When a guy gets hit by a fluke pitch and he breaks a bone in his hand, unless he's a guy that gets hit by 20 pitches a year, in which case, yeah, then you should kind of calculate that. I'm looking at Anthony Rizzo, Starling Marte, Derek Dietrich. These are guys that get plunked all the time. That's part of their ability to get on base. Maybe I discount them a little bit more. But for the most part, I avoid the pre-existing injury. If a guy's had like leg injuries in particular, that's going to always take longer. It seems like Josh Donaldson comes to mind with his quad injury the last 2 years prior to this year. There are certain bets you just don't take. It's kind of like the opposite of streaming against bad teams. You know, they're percentage plays. You're going to be wrong every once in a while, but for the most part, you're going to thank yourself for not adding on that extra weight. And it's especially true in like TGFBI or NFBC where there's no IL spots. When you have to stash them on your reserve and you need those spots for other things.
Man, I wish every league didn't have IL spots. And I know people say, oh, well, then you're screwing the team because then he has nowhere to put his hurt guys. When I have a bunch of hurt guys, I always feel the problem is more replacement than storage. I'll figure out who to keep. In those NFBC leagues, what you get, 7 bench spots, that's more than enough to hold the really important guys who get hurt. and still have some playability to the waiver wire. I go back and forth on this with a lot of people in the expert community, and a lot of people think I'm crazy to say this. Where are you right now on league construction with DL, IL spots?
I've come around to your point. In fact, it's so funny. We were talking about that on the show today, too. And it's like, yeah, you've kind of convinced me. I don't mind like setting aside what Yahoo does, like two spots. I think that's kind of, you got your elite guys that go down. You want to be able to replace them. That's fine. I get that. And you're not, but you can't account for all instances of fortune. Sometimes you're going to run bad. Sometimes you're just not going to get the same guys. I should rephrase that. Sometimes you're going to get one guy that gets seven total fluke injuries and it happens and they're all impactful and that happens. Look at Rudy Gamble and TGFBI, I think has like the ghost ship team right now. And that happens, but I like it. I like that the waiver wire is so much better in a non-IL league than it is in an IL league. Heck, you're in tout with me and you've played like only leagues, mono leagues with unlimited IL. I mean, the waiver wire is just a disaster land. You're stuck overpaying for half chances of guys. And maybe that's the way you want to play. I get it. I think in a mixed league format, I really, really prefer the lack of IL spots.
Yeah, in mono league, unlimited DL is just soul crushing. You look, you get an outfielder hurt and you go to the waiver wire to find anybody and you have guys who had three at-bats the previous week. It's like, man, you can't, there's no playability of the league. I get people. I understand that. Yeah, you know, I was disappointed that a couple of longstanding members of the Friends and Family League got out this year, and it's part because they didn't want to deal with the daily maintenance, which I think is a little bit overrated. I think the point is you do have to do daily maintenance to your team, but it can be 5 or 10 minutes. I'm not saying you have to go on FanGraphs and do a bunch of research. And by the way, some great research tools you've added to RotoWire,
yes,
including with the plate discipline metrics year over year, or the velocity stuff year over year, stuff that you used to kind of go looking for at needle in a haystack, or at least you'd have to do a couple of searches. Now it's like, boom, one button. It's like, oh, wow. You know, I didn't realize that, you know, Jim. Who was it? Jason Hayward's gotten so much better in this right. area, or Matt Chapman, or whoever it is. Unbelievable metrics. I'm not just saying this because Jeff's my friend and I like the RotoWire guys. The site is indispensable, and I believe you can get a 10-day free trial without a credit card. So I heartily endorse that. But, and by the way, Rudy Gamble, hell of a player. I hope to get him on this podcast one of these days. I got to ask you, you're a Cincinnati Reds guy. That's your own problem. I can't talk you out of that. You have Joey Votto in the Friends and Family League. In my Tout Wars league, I have Votto. It's an OBP league. I got a note from Michael Rathburn, mutual friend, also works for RotoWire. He was looking to deal pitching. He needed hitting. I offered him Votto, who's got the sore back, cranky back right now, to him for Cole Hamels and I think $69 a fab. That's based out of 1,000. So, you know, a little bit of fab. You know, that would be $7 in a $100 fab league. But basically, Votto, who I paid for about $30 for, maybe, you know, misguidedly, for Hamels, who was a $10 pitcher. We've only played 3 weeks of the season, and Rath didn't want to do it. I mean, I understand why he didn't want to do it. I think it's probably hard to trade in Tout Wars because a third of the league doesn't want to trade, and then a third of the league is like the Chris List. Well, I'll trade with you, but it's at a VIG. I'm always going to gain 15% on every trade we make. But yeah, I'm available if you want to do something. But what do you think about selling low in general? Are you surprised? I know everything is situational and contextual, but just in a nutshell, the fact that I couldn't get Votto for Hamels through, does that surprise you?
It does surprise me. If I were the Hamels owner and you offered me Votto, that deal, I think I'd snap call it, actually. But then again, you know, here's the thing about Votto. He's often been a slow starter. Very frequently has he started slowly. Then he gets into that tear like June, July, August, and he just doesn't make an out, period. Now, you could say that things are different. He's 35 now. He's got the back tightness. He actually popped up to first base. Things are changing. The world's collapsing. All this is true. So I get it. But man, I think I would have done that. But you know what? You and I have always made trades in Friends and Family. In fact, you've been time and again, you've been willing to do the sell low. It works for you a lot of the time. And I think one of the things is, and I know Fred Zinke is now a part of Yahoo crew too, and he's an excellent trader. And one of the things he does is he wins by trading in volume. He makes a lot of trades. He thinks that at the end of the day, he's, you know, 2 or 3 cents better on the dollar than others. And yeah, so he'll miss every once in a while. But you keep making lots of trades, and guess what? You know, the more of those you make, the more profit you make, and the better off you are at the end of the year. I fully endorse that plan.
The next time I have Zinke on, I think I'm just going to say trading, talk for 35 minutes, and just let Fred go. He's unbelievable. And you know what Fred understands, his trading success is a lot of different things. So I don't want to make it oversimplified, but the first thing is relationships. I mean, he's able to talk to anybody. He'll be reasonable with anybody. Even when we've discussed trades in leagues before and haven't gotten something done, at least we always have a conversation where I feel like there's mutual respect and we can come to a sort of agreement on how we see things. I just don't like the people who pee on your leg and tell you it's raining. I mean, that's frustrating. Fred never does that. He always, you know, he always can get in a good relationship with you. I'm looking to find some common ground with you. I'm looking at your friends and family league. I notice you have Jose Leclerc, who a couple of messy outings. They had to yank him from his last save chance. And the one previous, he was trying to blow it, and the home plate umpire was just giving him all these borderline calls to the point that the Angels were swinging at pitches nowhere near the strike zone because they had no idea what the strike zone was. I saw that Kelly was a hot pickup. It seems like maybe he's the number two guy in Texas. I know Leclerc did get the quote-unquote vote of confidence. Save chasing, such a pain in the neck. Same token, I don't want to add holds to leagues. I think 5x5 is the best format. Tell us where you are on Leclerc right now in that Texas bullpen.
Leclerc is where I am. What happens when you miss out on the run of closers and you think you can wait and get Tyler Yates and someone else likes Tyler Yates just as much as you. And then you're like, okay, fine, I'll take Leclerc. And, you know, blows up. I was at a stoplight and picked up Kelly last night as they were taking Leclerc out. So that's the only reason I have Kelly and friends and family. Otherwise, I'm sure someone would.
Stoplight. You weren't actually moving in the car, but you said you were not at moving.
I was stopped. I promise you I was stopped at the intersection of Duarte Road and San Gabriel Road. For those of you in the San Gabriel Valley area, when we do our San Gabriel Valley roads draft there, I'll be way up on everybody. But
who knew that LA traffic had been crushed to a standstill to the point that you could navigate your fantasy team while you're going nowhere?
Yeah, shocking, I know. But yeah, it's Leclerc walked like seven guys per nine just as little as recently as 2017. He's got great stuff, but he doesn't have that command, and that's concern. That's definitely a concern. Yeah, I think the thing is you just have to keep on adding, keep speculating. Early on, especially, you know, we have a lower transactions limit this year, something I do endorse, you know, and partially because I'm sick and tired of getting beat by Ryan Boyer and Gray Albright on every pickup that's possibly out there. Gray's beating us in other methods. He's destroying us right now, but that's another story for another day. Fact is, though, I mean, you just have to keep plugging away. I'm not high on Leclerc. I think that they gave him the contract. They gave him the endorsement, but at some point, you know, he could lose the job. I just hope that Kelly's the other guy so I can have them both at least.
I bid $19 on Hector Neris in a league that we're in together, labor yes. mixed league. I didn't even really need saves. I was a little bit over what people at the $100 fab league. So $19 is a lot. It's also a league where you can't make $0 bids. So running out of money is a problem. Mm-hmm. Are you confident that maybe, do you think there's a good bid? Do you think Neris could run away with the job? Or do you just think, you know, Kapler's too flaky? Eventually, maybe Robertson comes back. They have other options. Where do you stand on that bullpen?
I'm kind of never Kapler is where I'm at. Never. Although at the same time, if there's ever a time to bid on Neris, it's now. Because Robertson's hurt. They're using Dominguez in the sixth. You know, if there's ever a time that you could narrow the focus just a little bit, it's now. I bid $5 on him, by the way. So I was in on him, but I wonder how long lasting it's going to be. I wonder how long Robertson's going to be out. I wonder, whether Kapler changes his whim again tomorrow, Thursday, Friday. You never know. That's the thing. And by the way, Rocco Baldelli is AL for Gabe Kapler, I think, as far as closers go. Oh,
man, what a mess that Minnesota bullpen is. I look at some of the guys I bid on in labor this week. Jorge Lopez of the Royals, Nick Birdie, a reliever who's got absolutely silly stats in Pittsburgh right now. Robert Stevenson in a bullpen that may be a little bit unsettled. Jared Eichhoff is back in the Philadelphia rotation. I didn't really want to win the Homer Bailey bid, and I didn't, but I did have him as a down ballot guy. Tommy La Stella, I was the high bidder on, but I didn't get because for some reason I screwed up. I didn't have a drop on that ad list and because I thought I didn't need to do it, and turns out the way it gets ordered, I did. La Stella, Lopez, Birdie, Stevenson, Bailey, Eichhoff. Am I just throwing money in a fountain here? Or do any of these guys seem interesting to you?
I picked up La Stella in a league. I have Birdie in one. I mean, all you have to do is follow Rob Friedman on Twitter, Pitcher Ninja, mm-hmm. and you saw great that follow. Slider from Birdie. I'm like, oh, yeah. And then you look at the Kata Walk. It's all supported there. You look that Keone Kayla struggled. If anything's going to happen to Vasquez, it's probably going to be Birdie. Birdie wasn't available the same day that Vasquez wasn't available last week against the Tigers. That's the only reason why Kayla, I think, got the call, because Kayla hasn't been that great this year. So, but yeah, I and the thing is, it buttresses a point you made a while ago. Don't go spending, $6 on Andrew Miller of the year that Miller is still Andrew Miller. No, wait 2 weeks in, see who those emerging guys are. They're always there. Stevenson's another guy. Brandon Brennan in Seattle's another guy. Nick Anderson's another guy. They do emerge. They do come out there. And the thing is, you just have to be paying attention.
And I'm just hoping with Birdie, and I have a lot of Nick Anderson too. I know he allowed a couple home runs. This actually falls into two points I want to make. One, just get me the strikeouts. Anderson had an appearance where he allowed a home run, but he struck out three guys. Just get me the strikeouts. When my starting pitcher blows up a little bit, just get me five or six strikeouts anyway so I can feel like I got some mileage, some traction out of the start. In the case of Birdie, if he just continues to pitch well, and I mean, it's unrealistic to expect him to pitch as well as he had the whole season, but as long as he's giving me quality innings, I'll live with whatever wins and saves come my way. If they come, that's great. But I got him mostly because I'm following the skills here, and I'm just going to let the role sort itself out. Now, when a mediocre pitcher gets the role, you also have to consider that as well. But just get me the strikeouts. Just get me the quality innings, and I'll deal with if the other stuff comes or if it doesn't come.
Yeah, I'm the same way.
All right, man. I think we have exhausted the baseball talk of this podcast. We're going to get to the fun stuff now, our draft. If you're not a fan of golf, for shame. You should have been watching the Masters. You still should be in the afterglow of what Tiger Woods just did. It blows my mind. I went to a poker room the Saturday of the Masters. There's seven TVs on. They're ostensibly always on for sports. And I had to beg to get the Masters on, which, that's just not right. I should have just walked out of there and said, you cannot have my money. But golf is a great game. You and I are both big golf guys. We both go on golf trips, talk about golf. We're in a fantasy golf league. And yes, it is fun. It's also a DFS sport on Yahoo if you're so inclined. So you can make 1 week commitments at a time. And our draft day is going to be things we love about golf. I think I could probably go 15 rounds on this. We're just going to go five. I'm going to give you the first pick, Jeff. What is the first pick in our golf draft?
So this was brought into sharper focus this last couple of weeks. I had a really good friend, my regular foursome on Friday, pass away. Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. He's an awesome man. David Sanchez, we'll get that name out there in the air. Great man. And, we had amazing times together and all that. So it's the camaraderie. It's the bringing together with the people that, it's a very social sport. And that camaraderie, I have my golf trip. You have your golf trip. That's what I love most about golf is the time it brings us to common interests. It brings us together with my friends.
It's an awesome pick. Yeah, I had basically fellowship on my list, which is the same thing. There's that joke from The Office that Chili's is the new golf course. The golf course is a great place to make a deal. It's a great place to see pictures of kids. It's a great place to catch up with your high school, your college friends. It's a very social sport, and it's certainly one of the best things about golf. You left my first pick still on the board, so I can take it. I love that golf is a gambling sport. You could not step on a golf course and not have a couple of bucks riding on something, whether it's a team match, an individual match, it's a double or nothing match, it's the closest to the pin, whatever it is, stroke play, match play. Can I get up and down from this bunker? You just can't be on a golf course without there being some kind of bet involved. And I can't think of a sport. I mean, I played everything. I never was in a hockey game that had a pickup hockey game that had betting on it. Thankfully, I never bet on any of our tennis matches together because I would have gotten stomped every time. But there's something about being on a golf course that makes you want to gamble.
Yeah, for sure. And it's socially acceptable. In fact, it's almost encouraged. I mean, that there's a reason why we all carry handicaps, right? It's to level that bet. And it's something that's an official part of the game almost.
But it is illegal at Bushwood. I'd like to point that out.
Yeah, but I never slice, so it's all good. I like that place. Too, it's just the places you go, the courses themselves. Yes. I played Torrey Pines this week. This year. I went to the Masters at least for a practice round, but it was still, I was on this glorious, piece of earth. And, there's some amazing places, amazing golf courses, amazing vistas. I mean, the courses themselves.
Yeah, the uniqueness of courses was also on my list. Again, I've played every sport. I've never made a ranking of my favorite tennis courts or my favorite hockey rinks. Although there are some great hockey rinks, there are some great tennis courts, there are some great baseball diamonds, and baseball parks are really fun to collect. But when it comes to the sports that we play, the participation of sports we play, golf has something because it's just the uniqueness of it. No course is like any other course. You have favorite holes, you have holes you do well on, just courses that suit your eye or, courses that are on the water. That's an excellent pick and was going to be one of my early picks. And the second round, by the way, before I go to my next pick, just really quickly, just give us a takeaway from the Masters, something that surprised you, just a postcard moment. You were there for what, 1 or 2 days last week.
The elevation changes are way more extreme than you think. Mm-hmm. You know, like walking up 18, it's crazy how uphill that is. The green on number six, you tee off high from this high tee out down to the green. You don't see much of the front on TV, by the way. But the green itself is like there's half of it's like this huge mound in the middle of it. And if you're on the wrong tier, you're pretty much screwed if you don't get on the right tier. It's crazy. The other thing I do have to say is just the concessions are just insane. It's fast. They're good. They're cheap. And everyone is super friendly there. I mean, they get you in and out so quickly. You would not think that for the vast amount of people that go through. And it just it's so efficient. And an efficiency expert would be impressed with how Augusta does things.
I'm not going to say I'm on board with everything that is in Augusta's history, but I love the fact that they can make a lot more money in concessions than they do, and they're just not maxing out. I believe life doesn't have to be about maximizing right. profits constantly. And they obviously – look, they're selling a bunch of merchandise, and that's great, but they can get double or triple what they're charging, and they choose not to go that route. And, you know, kind of like the Falcons, right? If you go to a Falcons game, you know, the hot dog yeah. isn't going to set you back, you know, $12 or whatever. So I tip my cap to the people who decide you don't have to absolutely maximize every profit. My second pick is going to be putting. And okay. I love the fact that you have golfers who hit the ball great and can't putt, and that screws them up. You have some golfers who can't hit the ball that great, but they putt really well, and that can be an equalizer. If you're putting well, you feel like you're really, you know, you feel like you get $100 bills in your pocket. If you're not putting well, it gets in your head. It's kind of like a baseball team where you have that knockout Josh Hader reliever, and he's a weapon, and you always feel like, okay, we'll get Hader in this game. We'll get out of it. You know, putting is just the great equalizer in golf. There's a million ways to do it. You can do it really unconventionally, and it might work. If you're not putting well, it's, you know, I'm not sure anything can work. But I just love that one of the X factors in golf is putting. Most of my life, I've been a good putter. I had like a 3 or 4 year putting slump. I was overdue to probably get a longer, a heavier putter. It's really helped me
yep.
with my lag putting, and I've putted really well the last couple of years. But I just love the fact that putting is just that great equalizer and that great X factor of golf.
And I was I was that yipper for 10 years. I had a really long stretch and I finally got out of my own head and got another putter, and I'm still not great, but at least I'm passable again now. And it comes and goes. It really does.
And you're very humble, because if we were playing tomorrow, I know you'd be giving me strokes, probably a lot of them.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, I'm about an 18. You know, I have
You're better than an 18.
I'm not. In fact, you know, I've played enough rounds. I mean, I don't have an official handicap. I've never I don't register the USGA because
Jeff is shaving strokes on this podcast. Market here. If you play money matches with Jeff Erickson, he is lying about his handicap on national podcast.
I might have to screenshot what Golf Shot says my handicap is. I might, if I'm shaving, it's by a stroke at most. But I've been somewhere between a 17 and an 18 for the last couple of years. So there you have it.
Okay, Dave Sims. So there. You're up in the third round.
All right, third round. Dave Sims, that hurts. That's cold-blooded, dude. The feeling when you pure a ball, you know, it can be like mm-hmm. an 8-iron, you know, and you just hits it perfectly clean, goes where you want to, it lands where you want to. You think your way around the course and it actually happens. It's so cool. It's the shot that keeps you coming back.
Yeah, I think that's something everybody can identify with. Obviously, the great players feel it a lot, but it's amazing how you can have a round of golf where you can play really poorly and you can even think, I was going to play this week, you know, again, maybe I just won't, I mean, blah, blah, blah. And then you hit that shot, you don't feel it off the club. It has the majestic trajectory, you know, or maybe you chip in from off the green or something like that. It's amazing how that feels. There's no, and I don't think it matters how good you are. Everybody's going to hit one of those shots every once in a while, and it is intoxicating. That's a great pick in the third round.
Yep.
I'm going to go with a little bit similar to this, the sounds of golf. I love the way the spike sound in the parking lot. I love the way the ball sounds when it goes in the cup or when it hits the pin. I love the sound of a ball approaching the green and just that sound it makes, of the way a ball lands in the trap or exits the trap with that thunk. I just feel like there's a million sounds in golf and they're all really cool.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm totally with you on that one there. You can tell when someone, you know, that's one thing like at the Masters when I was going there, because if it was a practice round, we're like 10 feet away from these guys. You're actually allowed to have a camera on the course for there. You can't have a phone on the course, but and then the tournament itself, you're not allowed to have a camera, but the practice rounds you are. But anyhow, being so close, you could hear the sound coming off the club. It's just a different sound than we, you and I do it. Every once in a while, you get someone in your group that has a different sound to it too, especially off the tee. You can hear that thwack and you just tell it's a, they're living in a different universe than we are, a different plane.
Who's the best golfer in your group?
Tim Schuler.
Yeah, I thought it
might be Schuler by far.
Shout out to the great man, Tim Schuler.
Snap call.
Also the nicest golfer I know. Yeah. The great thing about Schuler, as Joe Sheehan once put it, is he's more excited about your great shot than he is about all the great shots he hit.
Yeah, that's right. That's absolutely right. My buddy Dave Sheeran and my Myrtle group is probably the on that plane when he's at his best. And actually, my favorite golfer to watch, though, is my brother. He does not get cheated on his swing. And little known fact, Doug Erickson is a good athlete, played a little high school, a little college baseball, played like every sport. You know, I could still beat him in tennis. So that was great. But every other thing, he just crushed me. And he played like high school varsity sport and whatever sport he wanted to. But he does not get cheated on his swings. It's fun to watch. And when we play scrambles together on our Myrtle trip, oh, it's amazing. It's so much fun. Loosen up a little bit, have a pop or two maybe, and we just start going and riffing off each other. We'll start playing really well too. It's just fun. But he is my absolute favorite golfer to watch.
Yeah, it's funny. My little brother and I play a lot, or when I say a lot, we play once or twice a year, but you know, that's a lot to me. And I think I was better than him at everything growing up, which is part of being older. But now he's better than me at everything. And he will be giving me strokes when we play later this season. But he's also a really good player. So you're up in the fourth round of our golf draft.
Yeah. Golf shirts. I have maybe 40 of them. It's my style. I like to wear just a, you know, I work from home. I can wear whatever I want. It's either t-shirt, but I like golf shirts. I like getting the souvenir of where I played. And especially when it's a great course, you know, like, oh, you went to Bandon Dunes? That's amazing. Yeah. And it is. And it's a talking piece and it's attire, all the same thing. So golf shirts.
Are you going to, now Tiger's bringing the mock turtleneck back. Are you going to be, is that a mock turtleneck you're wearing? I can actually see you on this podcast.
No, just a long sleeve tee.
You have a fashion, are you going to have a fashion revolution routed through Erickson?
No, I'm not. Never have, never will. My finger is not on the pulse of popular America.
So be it. My fourth thing is going to be the Ryder Cup, which is every other year, United States takes on Europe. And I think the players get some modest compensation, but it's basically a event for pride. It's an event for, you know, your country or, you know, the team that you're on. And it also ties into, I consider this making this a different topic, but I decided just to lump it together. Golf is a sport of naked emotion where we know what all the golfers look like. I mean, Connor McDavid could maybe walk by me in a shopping mall. I'm not sure I could place him, even though I'm a huge hockey fan, because, you know, hockey guys have helmets on and we don't always see them. But with the golfers, you see them. There's nowhere to hide in HD. And the game is very emotionally raw. And I think that's never more prevalent than the Ryder Cup, where these guys, they so badly want to be on the team. They want to be captain's choices. There's been a lot of dramatic comebacks in the Ryder Cup in 1999. The U.S. made a crazy comeback. Europe reeled in the U.S. a few Ryder Cups ago. Unbelievable event. I remember Hunter Mahan blowing a Ryder Cup, playing really poorly down the stretch and just crying at the press conference because he was so broken up about it. And I don't take any joy in him crying, but I love the fact that he cared so much that he was moved to tears. The Ryder Cup tied with the emotions of golf is my fourth pick.
You know, I'm still bitter at Phil Mickelson for switching clubs the week before the Ryder Cup, you know, switching like whole iron brand because of a sponsor, maybe 2 weeks before. Point being is he hadn't played a tournament with those irons, but it was good enough to try him out in the Ryder Cup. I'm like, how can you do that? And it's just ridiculous. So I'm not a huge
fan. The U.S. loses a lot is I think the U.S. sometimes has a sometimes they seem like a 12 players, 12 cabs kind of thing where they're all their own conglomerates and everything. Not that, look, I mean, Rory McIlroy's his own conglomerate too, but I just feel like the fellowship of the Euros helps them in that event. And it has been the reason why they've actually been a great bet historically over the past 20 years. I think they just enjoy being on a team together more than the U.S. players do. That may sound like a convenient thing to say, but it still seems true to me.
How do you change that, though? I mean, it's one of those things. I agree with you. I think it is true. I think the U.S. has tried to address that in some ways, and, you know, the way they've had selected their teams and all that. But, you know, I'm sure over the years they've tried to adjust that. But I think it's there. I really do think it is a thing. And I don't know if that's something that can be changed because it's just kind of fundamentally who these guys are.
Right. And you like who you like. You know, you just can't force guys to buddy up with each other. I mean, some people just go together and mesh well and some guys don't. And, you know, I don't know. I don't know how you fix that, but I think it's an interesting part of the Ryder Cup. So we both have one pick left. Jeff Erickson, fifth round of our golf draft.
Believe it or not, a lot of people use this as a negative why they don't do golf. And that's the time it takes. I like the time it takes. I like that I am out. I'm doing my thing with my friends. I'm in touch. I'm outside for 4.5 hours. It encourages long conversations. It encourages you kind of some patience there between shots. You can't kind of time to think of things. You're not rushing through things. So my big pet peeve when I'm golfing is when we're slowing people up behind us, or someone in my group is a little slower, or someone's waiting for us, and I feel like I have to hurry. I play poorly then, but I like the time it takes to play golf. I know you can't always allocate that amount of time, but I enjoy that time out there. It forces me to be offline. I like that.
Yeah, that's a great call. It ties into something I was considering that I'm not going to take, is it's also a great way, if you have the time, to take a Sunday nap. Just get on the couch, put on some golf. The announcing is really soft and tranquil, and usually I'll end up falling asleep for about 45 minutes, which is not a bad way to spend a Sunday afternoon. My final pick is going to be the literature of golf. There are just so many great golf writers. We just lost probably one of the best writers of all time in sports, and Dan Jenkins. But there have been so many great things written about golf in fiction, nonfiction. The Sports Illustrated Vault has a ton of great golf stuff. Some of the instruction is really great. The Harvey Pienick books, Golf Digest is really great. We have our mutual friend Jeff Ritter, who's a golf journalist, who's outstanding. I just love reading about golf. I feel like it has a very high level of writing about golf. And so the literature of golf is going to be my final pick.
I like it. You know, Jenkins was a good follow on Twitter, even. It wasn't just like, you know, his printed work is, you know, he was online. He was a funny follow, especially at the Masters. It was pretty great. So yeah, a good call. Very good call there.
Yeah, Jenkins, man. No BS guy. What a great man he is. Anything quickly that was left on your board that you did not pick?
I actually was going to say a little bit of the match play tournament, but the funny thing is I preferred the match play tournament before they made the changes. I like the original grid, just, you know, the pressure, you win or you go home. I think it's, you know, give me a grid on a lot of things. There's a reason why every once in a while you'll see a meme going around or a bracket going around of other, you know, people do, you know, vote on things or whatever. Brackets are fun. Give me more brackets.
Yeah. I like, they took the urgency out of the event. I don't like that. I do like the fact that it gets a really good field though. One of the problems for the Zurich Classic that's coming up this week, just too many good players aren't playing it, but most of the good players are in the match play. I just wish we just threw it on them right away that they had to win or go home. But, you know, what are you going to do? Some of the other things I was considering, Fred Couples, my favorite golfer of all time, and just that fairway gait that he has where he just walks around, you know, unconcerned about anything. One of my favorite things. And I know I'm in the minority here, and I know he's retired now, so maybe he's off the board. But I always thought Johnny Miller was one of the great announcers, because in a sport where a lot of times the announcers see no evil, speak no evil, Johnny Miller, I always thought, tried to tell the truth. Yes, sometimes it was self-aggrandizing for the things that he had done. He might have mentioned the 63 at Oakmont once or 10,000 times. But still, first of all, he shot a 63 in a major to win it. I mean, how could you not be proud of that? And he was a very honest man in a sport that even though I like a lot of the announcers, I just feel sometimes the announcers are more trying to promote you on the sport and tell you how great it is rather than tell you what's really happening. So I always enjoyed Miller for his honesty. And even though Couples is pretty much retired from, you know, the PGA Tour, he's going to play some senior events. He's just always been my favorite player. I'm glad he won the one major. I feel like he probably should have won more than he did, but I will always be in the corner of Fred Couples.
Yeah, I like him too. He was playing a practice round with Tiger. Actually, I got a good photo of him, Tiger. God, who else was playing with them? But they were walking side by side next to him. It was pretty cool just to be able to see that. You know, going back to Miller real quick, I'm with you on that. I just, some announcers can take a little too far. Brandel Chamblee in particular just annoys me. I think he needed to ask Brooks Koepka after the Masters, hey, had you not lost that weight, would you have made the green on 12? No, he was so aggressively wrong with Koepka. The point being, he was very aggressive because he seemed like he was trying to make a name for himself. Whereas Miller, I thought it was more organic. I thought he was less the carnival barker and more the actual honest critique of the game.
And has no idea, no problem with saying when people were great too. I mean, it's not like he's just looking to rip people. Right. Just to call it as he sees it guy. I mentioned Couples is my favorite golfer. Is there anybody past or present who particularly you're fond of? I'll keep this in mind for our next golf auction, but do you have a favorite current or past golfer?
Tom Lehman played the Hogan Tour. My brother caddied for him. He was super nice to him. Actually, he was in the same group. He didn't even caddy for him. He caddied for someone else who I don't remember, but Lehman was super nice to him as well. And I think it was in Wichita, Kansas, played well in that tournament. just carried himself very well. And I liked it when he won the British and all that. So I rooted for Lehman a lot.
Yeah, I'm glad he got that major because, man, it seemed like he and Colin Montgomery were in contention for every major. It felt like for like a 7 or 8 year period. And just blows my mind. Monty never won one. You know, Greg Norman, famously, another guy I considered, just Norman's career, man. I mean, two majors, but he lost every other major in just this incredibly dramatic, almost cruel fashion. You know, every major in a playoff he lost. Obviously, the Masters a year he melted down his career. Yeah. But Lehman just seems like a Midwestern guy, good values. I was always a fan of Lehman as well. Piercing blue eyes. So, Jeff, as I said, RotoWire OG, Jeff_Erickson on Twitter. Tell our listeners how they can keep up with you.
So not only Twitter, but also on SiriusXM, obviously. I'm on Monday through Thursday. That is 11 to 1 Eastern time. I often do the Sunday show, which is 1 to 3 Eastern time. You can catch us on RotoWire, rotowire.com/free. Get your free 10-day trial. Scott mentioned that earlier. Appreciate that. So you can check out our articles, our player news, our rankings, all that good stuff. rotowire.com/free.
Awesome, man. Awesome. Thanks so much for doing this. Put a wrap on our 8th episode. For our great producer, Brett Rader, for Jeff Erickson, our guest today, I am Scott Pianowski. You can catch me on Twitter at Scott_Pianowski. We'll be back next Monday. We already have a guest lined up, and I guarantee you he's a great one. So stick with us. Keep those comments coming. Keep those ratings and reviews coming. They do help the discoverability of the podcast, and they help me sleep at night. So for Jeff, for Brett, I'm Scott. Let's go play some baseball. Let's go play some golf.